this is, you should see me when I'm not, this is part two of class three. And we're in the 1970s and we're at the election campaign, but I've given you quite a lot of information about the Conservative Manifesto. Now, of course, manifestos are what they, the most important things that the party wants to put in front of the electorate. And they are things that they intend to do, but sometimes when, if they realise it's going to be difficult, they say something a bit vague, which is, you know, which is de bonne guerre, as you say, which is fair enough. So I better talk about the Labour Party Manifesto. Have we got a Labour Party picture? No. Okay, so the Labour Party Manifesto. What did they say in the Labour Party Manifesto? Well, the Labour Party activists were distributing the Labour Party Manifesto, published under the title Now Britain's Strong, Let's Make It Great to Live In. That's their slogan, yeah. Now Britain is strong, let's make it great to live in. Now, they were obliged to say Now Britain is strong because they were the they've been the government for the last 6 years, so they can't say the situation is terrible. Because the government doesn't normally work that way. Now, I think I need to keep hold of this document as well. Yes, it's my list of slides. So, what did they say in this manifesto? Now, the manifesto naturally defended the government's record since 1964. The word planning occurs 20 times in the manifesto. I counted. And this approach is contrasted with that of the Conservatives, who, according to the Labour Manifesto, are accused of wanting a free-for-all and of only desiring to defend the interests of a minority of richer people. This is very clearly and quite aggressively stated. I quote, they, the Conservatives, have always defended the power and privileges of the few. Okay, so it's fairly clear what the criticism is. The Labour Manifesto declares, we reject the Tory view that misfortune is a private, not a social concern. And the manifesto gave details of planned increases in social benefits for disabled people, sick people, and in particular, old age pensioners. Old age pensioners are a particular electoral group. They are, on average, more conservative than the rest of the population. And so they are also in Britain, they go out to vote more than the rest of the population. So from an electoral point of view, they can be pretty important. On education, the manifesto expressed pride in the establishment of the Open University and in the introduction of comprehensive schooling. It announced the intention of Labour to oblige those conservative local authorities who were refusing comprehensive schools to follow the rest of the country and accept them. Interestingly, although the desire to combat race and sex discrimination is underlined, the manifesto made no mention of some of the most important Labour government reforms of the 1960s. No mention of the legalisation of abortion, no mention of homosexuality. No doubt it was felt that significant minorities were still hostile to these reforms among the electorate, so they were best not mentioned. Indeed, the 10% of the population who were Catholics, many of them working-class Labour voters with Irish roots, were generally uneasy about the legalisation of abortion. When you're thinking about Catholics in England, you have to remember it's a very different country. It's a working-class religion of a 10% minority. So you know, it just doesn't work the same way as it does in France. On foreign policy, Labour, remember the Conservatives didn't say much about foreign policy, but Labour expressed its satisfaction in having reduced Britain's military presence east of Suez and repeated its determination to work with the Commonwealth against the white supremacist regimes in Rhodesia and South Africa. And the manifesto presents these two regimes as friends of the Conservative opposition. There were Conservatives who were against Rhodesia and South Africa, but it was not unreasonable. They had a lot of friends and the Conservative opposition. And that's all I had to say about the Labour Manifesto. So let's go right ahead. The election campaign. We're still in May 1970, and the election is in June, yeah. So I give you the manifestos a month earlier because that's, you know, the campaign lasts a few weeks once the Prime Minister has decided when it's going to happen. So what was happening in May? Well, there was a big hoo-ha with Rolls-Royce. The company Rolls-Royce of course, famous for its cars. That's a 1970 car. But also, they also made aircraft engines, which actually, in a lot of ways, were more important for them from a purely money point of view, you can imagine. It's a company which has been considered important by British government symbolically. You know, most people think that Rolls-Royce is pretty good quality, and so the British have not been very proud of it. And this is important because when you're looking for new trade deals, new contracts in other countries, having companies which are recognised, even in China, Korea, you know, it's very important. You know, and if you're a company from Portugal saying we're just as good as Rolls-Royce, then you have a disadvantage because Rolls-Royce. Yeah. In any case, they were in difficulty, financial difficulty, and they negotiated a £20 million loan from the government. This was important symbolically because this was opening up the question, this is the Labour government still, this is opening up the question of what should the government do when a company has financial difficulties. So in general terms, the Labour Party would be in favour of more intervention, more loans, or even, if necessary, investment or nationalisation even, perhaps. Whereas the Conservatives, who are not completely opposed to assisting, nevertheless, they consider it a bad thing, a last resort, etc. Those are the economic arguments against them. In sports and politics too, the South African cricket team had organised a tour of Britain, which was cancelled now. It was cancelled by the government. And the reason it was cancelled was because, let's do a guessing game. How many black players do you imagine were in the South African cricket team in 1970? Yeah, zero, absolutely zero, yeah. And so accepting the South African cricket team to do a tour of Britain was seen by many protesters, but also, and perhaps more importantly, by black African countries as unacceptable activity and so, in fact, a number of African and Asian countries had threatened to boycott the Commonwealth Games. The Commonwealth Games is a sort of mini Olympics, but it is important. It's important for getting contacts, trade, and so on. So that was a decision, but it also shows something else, because the government had agreed to the tour and then cancelled it after protest. So, you know, so it wasn't a matter of principle. They agreed to it and they cancelled it after protest. Now, this kind of boycotts of South Africa led to many white South African cricket players leaving the country, leaving South Africa and going to play cricket in another country. This is not surprising, you know, because you've got to remember how sport works. Even if you're in a racist country, you do the sport because you just love the sport and you've got to do that sport, yeah. And so if this means you have to go and live in Canada, well, that's life, you know. And so, in any case, in South African apartheid in the 1970s seemed as if it was going to last a very long time. And the anti-apartheid movement in Britain, who you can see here, was one of a series of movements around the world calling for the boycotting of South African products and sports teams in order to weaken the regime. This movement was supported by a number of governments around the world. In the 1970s in the UK, apart from customer boycotts, you know, don't buy South African sherry, there were also attempts to deal with the fact that a huge amount of British money was invested in South Africa by banks, and in particular at the time, Barclays Bank. Students around the country went on rent strike, refused to pay rent to their university because their universities were either investing in South Africa or banking with Barclays Bank. And so this was a bit of a student movement. In fact, I remember one of the rhyming slogans when I was at university. It was addressed to the university governing body, the Conseil d'Administration. It was, you say you won't discuss it, we'll give you the facts. It's sherry for the dons and bullets for the blacks. That's a nice poetic slogan there. Okay, so that's the political event. So this is linking in then both with questions of racism and with questions of decolonization. To go back to divorce and things like that, we got another reform along this line, and a new law abolished actions for breach of promise. Before 1970, if your boyfriend said, "I will marry you," and then 6 months later he said, "Oh, I'm not going to marry you," you could take him to court for breach of promise. Really? Yeah. But you can't after it does sound like a different world, doesn't it? It sounds like sort of really pretty old-fashioned. And also another thing which was which in a way is even more shocking is that before 1970, although I think this law had not been used for a long time, if a man's wife was unfaithful, the man could go to court and demand damages from the woman's lover. Des dommages et intérêts. Yeah. Okay, so yeah. it's out there. Now some of this is a sort of tidying up of laws which had already stopped being used, but not that long ago, maybe 10 or 20 years earlier. But it does show something, you know, I think it shows something of the social changes which were still going on. Now, sometimes you get in French, and even some of my colleagues do this, the difference between, they talk about réforme sociale and réforme sociétale. Have you heard this distinction?
Yes.
The general idea is that social is more economic and societal is more about the mirth. Personally, this is a distinction I don't like to use because it kind of suggests that they're not so important, réforme sociétale. So I'm not very happy with that, and I try to avoid it. But you will see it around. And generally, sociétal means about you as an individual and not you as a worker or an employer. Yeah, so it's like... it's also true that they cost a lot less money. That's true. Absolutely. Okay. So this again is part of a long process where the state reduces its intervention in people's personal lives. Across the world, things are going on because in the United States there is a demonstration against the Vietnam War in May 1970, and the army is sent in, and they shoot the demonstration. They shoot 67 bullets, and 4 students are killed on the demonstration. Now, this was a very important stage. This was a point where the majority of Americans were not sure about the war in Vietnam, and this was one of those key moments when majorities go, "Oh, well, that's enough, yeah, that's enough." Now, this is quite rare, but also it's interesting to see that in Britain we haven't had incidents like this, except in Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland being the big exception. Whereas, of course, there have been in Paris during demonstrations about the Algerian War in the 60s, where quite a lot of people killed, yeah. So here you have the horrible, I'm sorry to show you this horrible picture, but here you have the actual picture, and here you have the in memory of the four people. I'm mentioning a few events from around the world because, of course, that's what people talked about all day that day. You know, so it affects people locally. If we move on to June, we find that 4 people were killed when a bridge collapsed while it was being built. And this terrible work accident led to the change of the law and introduction of new standards for box girder bridges. I'm trying to find statistics, but one of the important things about the 1970s and the 1980s is the decline of the number of people killed at work and the improvement of safety standards. You're talking about a lot of people here. So this is really a continuation. In many ways, the welfare state is a process and not just a thing. And so the idea was launched in the 50s, but it kind of continues. And it's true that certainly today, if you imagine that, I already mentioned that, you know, if a lot of people are being killed at work, we very rapidly think, oh, well, this is the government's problem. We don't just say, oh, well, it's a problem of the private companies. The government can't do anything. We had a new independence. Tonga gained its independence from the United Kingdom. I know nothing about Tonga, and I'm only mentioning it just to say that every year in the 1970s, there were a couple more independences. It was still happening. Yeah? And that mattered, especially for people who came from Tonga. It also reminds you that there were hundreds of British colonies, you know, with lots of them that the British had never heard of. As the election campaign continued in May 1970, opinion polls were showing Labour several points ahead a week before polling day. And if Labour had won, Siobhan Lamesh, they didn't win, Edward Heath would no doubt have had to resign as Conservative leader. But I've already said stuff about him. In any case, the election did happen, and there was a new government, fair enough, and there he is on the day, on the very day in June 1970, in front of 10 Downing Street. And something else about 10 Downing Street is that in the 1970s, you could just walk past it and say hello to the policeman. You did?
Yes.
Yes. At the time, were you surprised that there wasn't more security?
No.
No, that was the 1970s. No. You just walked in front of one policeman without a gun, who is not carrying a gun, always stood in front of 10 Downing Street, and you could come up and say hello to the policeman or deliver a parcel. Now, you cannot get into the streets, even. There's the bars and gates in front of the streets. There's a change in... I suppose some of this... There was a terrorist attack on Downing Street in the very end of the 1970s, which was not successful, but... You know, but I guess that terrorism is the name of the game. So, Heath named his new cabinets Alex Douglas-Home, ex-leader of the Conservative Party, became Foreign Secretary. Ian MacLeod became Chancellor. And Reginald Maudling became Home Secretary. I am keeping to the minimum the number of names I give you, so if I give you a name... The ones you need to know. he had 25 ministers, but if I give you 25 ministers' names, that will not be useful, will it? Just keep you down. And also, important thing, again, as I mentioned, what does not happen is very important. Enoch Powell did not get a job. And that's important because it meant that Enoch Powell had to orient his career differently. He might have calmed down if he got a job, you never know. There were a number of things... This is not correct anymore. There are a number of things important happened in this election. The Welsh Nationalist Party, Plaid Cymru, obtained 11.5% of the vote in Wales. So pretty respectable. I mean, if you're a small party, you're not expecting to. 11.5 is you get invited onto the television. You know, if you have 2%, they don't invite you to the television. These are important things. However, it did lose its only member of parliament at the same time. Laurence Olivier, the actor, and here he is, playing Richard III, I think. Henry, thank you. Henry II. You're absolutely right. He's about to attack once more into the breach, dear friends, etc. And here he is. Not, I don't know what he's doing there. Anyway, and he was made a lord. It was the Queen's birthday, not her real birthday, but her official birthday. And on the Queen's birthday, on the recommendation of the Prime Minister, a whole bunch of people are made into lords or ladies. This distribution of official honours has long been reserved to specific sections of the elite, and they are extremely important to certain sections of the elite. It's not, I mean, of course, we're all very French with you're a lord, you're not a lord, who cares? They really care. It's very, very important to them, to the section of the elite. So I'm not going to give you a list of everybody who became a lord. What is new here? Laurence Olivier was the first actor to be made a lord, and that was important because for many, many decades, the theatre and the cinema were too vulgar to enter the House of Lords. And this is beginning to change in the 1970s, and eventually there will even be knighthoods for pop singers like Elton John. Elton John. So this is... Now, I can't say that I consider Elton John being made a lord as a major progress for humanity, but you know, I mean, it's an interesting change going on. So we're talking again about a certain liberalisation, even of very rigid elite institutions. Because when you talk about liberalisation, you've got to measure where it's happening, because ordinary people may be being more liberal, or institutions, or really elite institutions, and that makes a difference. The Methodist Church was obviously jealous of the Church of Scotland and decided, yes, women can be ministers. So women were for the first time allowed to become full ministers in the Methodist Church. This very slow process of making it possible for women to participate in all aspects of public life began in the 19th century and still continues today. The Church of England will allow women priests after 1994, and women bishops after 2014. Yeah, so you're lucky. You were born in time to become a woman bishop. No, no. Okay. It sounds kind of fun. In Northern Ireland, Bernadette Devlin was arrested, and Bernadette Devlin is an important name. She's one of the leaders of the nationalist Catholic political movements, the civil rights movements, and so on. She was also very young. She looks about 15. She can't be, but she is very, very young. July 1970. July 1970. Then there was fighting between British soldiers and the IRA soldiers in Belfast. 5 civilians were killed, and 10 British soldiers were injured. And in the 12 months that followed, 10 British soldiers were killed in Belfast by the IRA. Now, you can't memorise all the statistics. And I'm not going to tell you every time there's a fight. It's not going to work. So let's have a look at the general situation. You're talking about, here you have the figures of the number of people who died in the Northern Ireland conflict every year. 71, 150. The worst year is 72 with 400. And you can see you're around 200 a year for a while, and then around 100 a year for a while. It goes right up to 90. Yeah. I think today we're around 3 or 4 people a day. Yeah. So you can see that this situation, though obviously this is something very destabilizing for a democracy to have military conflict within the borders, but at the same time, it's nowhere near the number of people killed in car accidents. I'm not saying it's not important. There are more things to say about this. One is that although we remember the IRA for blowing up British soldiers, this was only one part of a much bigger strategy, which was economic. Destroying, making the occupation of Northern Ireland too expensive to continue. So it was about destroying buildings that you have to rebuild. Yeah, and so destroying buildings and infrastructure was very, very important. So there were kind of 3 sides to it. There was a terrorist side to it, that is to make a section of the English population so frightened that they want the British troops to leave. There was an economic war side to it. Let's just destroy the railways and the factories and so on, so that it's costing so much to the British that they leave Northern Ireland, which they don't. In the 60s, there was discussion about perhaps reunited Ireland. Once the military conflict began, that appeared to be impossible. But in the 60s, it was not a taboo subject. And we have on the other side then the division of who died. 691 people died who were not from Northern Ireland. And I think we're assuming that most of those are British soldiers, yeah? 1,250 Protestants and 1,525 Catholics. Now, this can be for a number of reasons. Civil wars are not very pretty things. So the IRA would sometimes kill people who were spying, Catholics who were spying for the British Army, and vice versa, and all that, every possible thing. But I think it is important to remember that the killing was not generally the objective. The objective was to make it impossible for the British to continue to have Northern Ireland. I will come back to that. In the same month, Roy Jenkins was elected. But there you have the slogan from the 1970 election, Now Britain's Strong, Let's Make It, what is that, a great place to live in? of a bizarre slogan, really, isn't it? But that was a slogan at the time. It was very 1970s. There you see then Roy Jenkins elected deputy leader of the Labour Party in July 1970. Roy Jenkins was an important leader of the right wing of the Labour Party. Throughout the 1970s, he felt that concentration by Labour on values such as the nationalisation of industry or close cooperation with trade unions was harming the party. That's not the way to win elections, he said. And so he believed there was a need for Labour to promote a more market-orientated policy. In the 1980s, when official Labour Party policy moved left, he left the Labour Party along with Shirley Williams and a few more to form a small breakaway party, the Social Democratic Party. Now, that was in the 80s, but it's quite important because I mentioned to you that the British electoral system favours the big parties. So people try to avoid splitting off and forming another party. Whereas, you know, in France a few years ago, you had the Parti de Gauche, which came out of the Socialist Party. But in the French system, it's easier to be a small party. In the British system, it's really hard to be a small party. And nevertheless, they left. It cannot be said it was a great success. It lasted a few years, and then joined the Liberals. So, which is, you know... but he is the guy. Now, the other thing which goes on is that the election of the leader and the deputy leader of the Labour Party has been organised in different ways over the last few decades. Who should elect the leader? Should it be just the Labour MPs? Should it be every member of the Labour Party? These are difficult questions, and both of them have argument. And some people said it should be only members of Parliament because they have been elected by millions of people. It's democratic. And other people said, no. The Labour Party members should elect them because they're there to represent the Labour Party members. We don't want with the fact that they were elected by other people who are not Labour Party members is not important. In the 1970s, it was the members of Parliament who elected. Just the members of Parliament elected, and that's important. In particular, because today in Britain it's not the case. All members of the Labour Party elect, and this is what's causing the tremendous conflict at the moment, because the members of the Labour Party, there are today nearly a million members of the Labour Party today, and they have elected a very left-wing leader, Jeremy Corbyn, and the members of Parliament don't like him at all. Yeah, and so you have this conflict of legitimacy, which is, well, I don't know how it will be finished. Now, I'm not going to talk very much about today, but there are moments when the comparison is obvious, and if you write half a sentence about today, that will be good. Yeah, when the comparison is obvious, you know. Yeah, don't hesitate. Remember what they're fundamentally asking. Remember, there's a program, of course. But what they're saying is, you know, is this the person I want to be a professeur agrégé, or is it this person? And so, if you have a good reason to show that you know other things about Britain today, then obviously that's a good thing. It's a little plus. Now, it only works if you also show you know the 1970s. But don't feel hemmed in. They really want to look at the... And this is the same in the orals. They look at you and say, is this a teacher? Yeah. Which is one reason that you need to dress like a teacher. It's really dress like a teacher because they want to know if you're a teacher or not. It's not the right day to be excessively adventurous. Okay. Roy Jenkins. I have a... Did I put up a? I put up a video about Roy Jenkins. Yeah. So that's important. He's
as well as the debate between him and Tony Benn
about Europe. That's right. Yeah. So there's a couple of videos that mention him, and I do recommend them. He's a particularly important figure. Meanwhile. It's the summer, and August is the rise of the Isle of Wight Festival. Festivals are getting bigger and bigger in the 1970s in Britain. And this Isle of Wight Festival, we're very happy because there was Jimi Hendrix, The Who, Joan Baez, Jethro Tull, The Moody Blues, and The Doors. Yeah, so half of them British and half of them not. it's quite impressive in a way, because it's like, you know, this is 40 years later and you've heard of half of these people, so they were pretty good. I mean, it's true that the 1970s in general, but in particular in Britain, but in general for popular music, are difficult to compete with, you know, by any other single one. More than 500,000 people attended. The Isle of Wight organisers had taken the idea of the festival, which had been appeared in the 1960s, and they tried to organise it a bit. So this was not free, whereas many of the festivals had been free. This was not free, but they had toilets and fences and things. You know, it was much more serious. It was becoming professional. This was part of the professionalisation of the music festival. Another kind of music festival, also in August 1970, was causing a bit of a ruckus, and this was the Notting Hill Carnival, also in August. And the Notting Hill Carnival goes back to the 60s, but it was quite small. Today, you get 500,000 people there, and it is. Music and dancing from the West Indies, Jamaica, Trinidad, and so on. It's a very important event because having a carnival of Caribbean music in the streets is about saying, we are at home, this is our home. It's not just liking the music, it's putting it on in a spectacular manner in the streets. Yeah, we are at home here. And this is why quite a lot of races don't like it. Exactly why? Well, it's really, if they don't like it, they could just not go. But no, they are opposed to it. This is much better today. But in the 1960s, in the 1970s, the London police was regularly tempted with trying to stop it. And there was in August 1970, there was a certain amount of fighting between the police and young black men at Notting Hill Carnival. So this is part of the process of immigration, racism, and in particular the children of immigrants saying, hey, we don't want to keep quiet anymore. And I have a video in mind for next week on that. A new political party was established in Northern Ireland, the Social Democratic and Labour Party, which was an attempt then, the Social Democratic and Labour Party, which was an attempt to have a party which was not directly based on the question of United Ireland or not United Ireland, and tried to base it on a class base. It had some important influence, but it never, it doesn't seem to have been possible to get the centre of politics in Ireland to be anything except the question of United Ireland or not United Ireland, because it's the elephant in the room, if you like. In September, you have the first Glastonbury Festival, so there's a series of festivals going on, which is still going on today, and it's very big, and it's also the number of festivals in Britain today is huge. I mean, far more than the 70s, absolutely enormous. And other symbolic things were going on as well. In September 1970, this couple of English composers and lyricists, Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, released the album. Now the show was a little earlier, a couple of years earlier, I think, of Jesus Christ Superstar, which was based on the Gospels, but with one very, very, very important difference from the Gospels. What was the difference? The last scene is on the cross. So the Christians were not so happy. No, that's not supposed to be the last scene. The whole point is that you have to die and then you have to resuscitate. Otherwise, it's not impressive. You know? So, I mean, anybody can die on a cross, you know. The clever bit is dying and then coming back to life again. You know? And so it is not an anti-Christian thing. They leave the question open at the end. Yeah. I don't know, how many people know this piece? Yeah. I do recommend it. It's very, very good. I mean, it puts the story of Jesus into a political context. It's sort of as if it was New York gangs from the 1970s, as well as being very good musically. I'm sorry that people don't know it. Oh, well, you need to know this. Yeah, you need to know this. It's very good. Isle of Wight Festival. North Sea Oil was again in the news because another important oil field was discovered by British Petroleum. And I think I've already said the things that I wanted there. But certainly, tax policy was extremely favourable to the oil companies at the beginning. But slowly, the revenue for government became important. Most of the financial benefit to governments came in the 1980s. This is logical because at the beginning, you're building big, expensive things. And once you've built them, then you start making money from the oil. But it takes 10 years. It takes time. That is to say that the governments who really benefited from were the Thatcher governments of the 1980s. This is something that was discussed in the Labour Party because in 1978, when they were 77, 78, when the Labour government was not very stable, they were thinking a little bit: if we can survive 3 or 4 more years, the money will be coming in. And you know, of course, ideas are important, but obviously, if you have more money to do things for your people, that's an advantage politically. Politically, North Sea oil will also have two other major impacts. First of all, it would slowly undermine the dependence of the country's economy on coal, and therefore it would much reduce the power of the mining unions, the most powerful unions in Britain by a long way. This is partly for accidental. Oh, it's partly because you had to build a good union, and all people died in the mines every week. You know, so it's, but also, the miners tended to live in mining villages, so it's a very, very close community. And if you didn't follow what the union had decided together, you had to leave town and go and live somewhere else. That's literally true, and I know people who had to. Because miners' trade union was the strongest. Now the miners had not had a national strike since 1926, but they would have two very powerful strikes in 1972 and 1974, which will be at the centre of political, they were on the front page for weeks and weeks, and will be in the centre of political questions of who's going to win the election. I will talk about this in a couple of years' time here, because Edward Heath ran one of the elections in February 1974 under the slogan, "Who runs the country? Is it me or is it the miners' unions?" Yeah. So it's a very remarkable thing. Secondly, enormous political effect is the fact that the oil was off the coast of Scotland. And I told you then that it gave a boost to the Scottish National Party. Just another thing about the Scottish National Party, while I'm back with the Scottish National Party, remember its name, the Scottish National Party, not the Scottish Nationalist Party. This is not an accident. When they formed the party, they wanted an alliance between people who wanted independence and people who wanted more power for Scotland, but maybe not independence. If you want to make a party which is big, you have to make some compromises, and you're stuck with the old question: what is an acceptable compromise? And in fact, in the 1970s, when they begin to talk about an autonomous parliament for Scotland, which will be the subject of the referendum in 1979, there is a division inside the Scottish National Party. Some people say, an autonomous parliament, that's treachery. We want independence. Independence or nothing. And other people say, no. An autonomous parliament is the first step. And so this is a political argument about what strategy is best. It does seem that the people who said first step were right. Because now, 30 years later, we've seen that the result of having an autonomous parliament is that when there was the referendum for independence, they nearly won. Now, okay, the independence isn't there yet, but the level of support for independence was so high that it seems difficult to imagine that without an autonomous parliament that would happen. So it seems that from a pragmatic point of view, that one group was right. Sometimes you can tell 40 years later, because it's not very useful to tell 40 years later. The other thing that's happening in the same month, October 1970, we're almost through the entire year of 1970, Pope Paul VI canonised not the 40 martyrs of England and Wales, but the 40 martyrs of England and Wales, as you probably guessed. This is to say, these are Catholics who were killed, but mostly by Elizabeth I for their faith. And there you have the little badge, yeah, the 40 martyrs of 1970. The Catholic population of the United Kingdom stood at around 10% and had done for quite a long time, far higher in Northern Ireland, maybe 40%, and higher in Scotland than in England and Wales. Most Catholics went to separate Catholic schools, which were not private schools, in the sense that no fees were charged for the pupils, they were free. They were run with government money, but they were managed by the Catholic diocese. That is to say, the diocese had considerable control over what was taught in the schools, but there was, in any case, no national curriculum in British schools at this time. Curricula for children from 5 to 14 were controlled by the local education authorities or by the Catholic diocese in the case of Catholic schools. Curricula for children 15 and 16 years old were in practice largely set by the regional examining boards. So these are some of the specific things about education. First of all, separate education, but not private, for Catholics. And the other schools were mostly Church of England, but very often anybody who was not Catholic, they said that the Protestant school, you know, we considered Muslims to be a particular form of Protestant, you know, it was all the same. They're not Catholics, you know, so well, who cares? Of course, in Catholic schools, they had to teach a lot of... Well, in all schools, religion was obligatory. However, the form of teaching of religion changed, not just because the churches became more liberal, but also because you try to teach 40 kids a very traditional religious lesson, they don't want it. Whereas if you say, okay, well, let's talk about religion and morals and, you know, and citizenship, then you can keep the kids on board. It was no longer possible to do things in that way. So the 40 martyrs. Yeah, I remember they used to get us to sing a hymn when I was at school, which was about how we would like to be martyrs. Really, it was a, how sweet would be thy children's fate if they, like them, should die for thee. And I'm like, ooh, just a moment here. Yeah, I was eight, you know. I think, oh, yeah, I'm not sure about this at all. At all. This photo is actually later because I couldn't find a photo from November 1970. But in November 1970, the Gay Liberation Front organised its first London demonstration. Okay, so this is not from the first one. This is from 2 years later, but, you know, you get the idea. And there are a number of things. Now, unfortunately, I mean, really, what I should do is ask you questions about it and so on. I don't really have the time, so I'm just going to tell you stuff. There are a number of interesting things here. First of all, notice the humour, very British, yeah? Homosexuals are revolting. Jeu de mots révoltant ou en révolte, yeah? Notice the political side, gays against fascism. You can see behind two organisations, in fact one organisation, the Campaign for Homosexual Equality, the London group and the Brighton group. You can see that the demonstration is quite small, because here you have, you know, the London group, and there's 10 people, and there's, it's small, this is even in 1972. You can see there's quite a lot of police. Now, very often when you go to a demonstration, you might be a little worried about the police. I suspect the police were really there to defend them, because it's still quite a hostile situation. But notice also that they're obviously not armed, even with a stick or anything like that. But the most important thing is that you do not see here the political parties, Labour, International Socialist, International Marxist Group, Greens, and it didn't exist yet, the Greens. Yeah, where are the left-wing... they're not there. They're not there. It's not our problem, it's the general attitude at the time. Now, there were certainly members of them, individual members of the political parties, because, you know, if you know how to do demos, you know how to do demos. But officially, it was a very much a divisive question that people... Yeah, the legalization in 1967 of homosexual relations for men over 21. Notice that the sexual majority for heterosexuals was 16. So there's a big difference here. And this did not imply a general acceptance of homosexuality or of homosexuals by the elite or by the general public. Although it's very difficult to know, before 1967, it's very difficult to know the state of public opinion about the state of public sympathy for homosexuals. Very, very difficult. Because people didn't talk about it. But there are some signs that, that there's a lot of autobiographies, and there are some signs that people got more support, than that homosexuals got more support locally and in their workplace than you might expect. Generally because, you know, people would discover that somebody, who a friend of theirs for a long time, then they would discover they were homosexuals, and they would say, well, yeah, it's still Bill, you know, and so, you know, people... And go. Attitudes, in any case, improved slowly during the 70s, partly due to the fact that fewer gays felt obliged to be absolutely secretive about their relationship. Nevertheless, homophobia was extremely common. When in 1977 the Tom Robinson Band released the song Sing If You're Glad to Be Gay, they were expecting a very hostile reaction indeed, and were surprised to find many crowds of young people singing along in solidarity. So in fact, things were changing subterraneously without being seen. I've read the interview with Tom Robinson. He said, we were asked to sing, he'd written the song to sing in gay clubs, and then they asked him to sing it at general concerts. And he said, yeah, I was terrified. And in fact, it was very well received. So there's some interesting things going on. There was, at this time, the newspaper Gay News had been founded, and this reflected for a long time the struggles of this minority. Also in November, there was the trial of the Mangrove Nine, Mangrove, M-A-N, there you go, the Mangrove Nine. Nine black activists were on trial for inciting to riots when they organized a demonstration against police harassment of a particular restaurant, the Mangrove restaurant, and they were all found not guilty of inciting to riot, of provocation à la meute. And this was important because it was a symbol. Yeah, it was considered a symbol of the campaign against police racism, which will become much more important in the 90s. And in fact, in 1999, I think, will result in the publication of an official report headed by a judge, which will say the London police are institutionally racist. The official report by a judge, you know. So, you know, that was a political dynamite. But this is long before, and this is one of those, these are the nine people who were arrested for inciting to riots. Dreadful news for Beatles fans. It isn't terrible. In April 1970, Paul McCartney had declared that he was going to do a solo album and leave the Beatles, and this actually happened. The split actually happened in December. Then the Beatles split up after 10 years of playing together. Apart from selling millions of records, they were no doubt responsible, along with Bob Dylan, for establishing the idea that pop music could be taken seriously as an artistic endeavour. They were continually trying to introduce new sounds and new themes in their albums, and this way of looking at themselves, rather than simply as entertainers, became a template for the next generation of rockers. In particular, those groups loosely held together by the label Progressive Rock. Yes, Jethro Tull, Genesis, Pink Floyd, with their showcased virtuosity, long tracks and concept albums followed wholeheartedly this league. So progressive rock is one of the genres of rock. It does not mean progressive in a political sense. It means progressive in taking it seriously as art. You know, the songs have to be, you know, 15 minutes long. Led Zeppelin, Stairway to Heaven, things like this. The other thing which was particular about progressive rock is that they abandoned one of the centers of rock and roll, which was looking sexy on stage. Yeah, you know, Elvis Presley and all that. That was a central thing for rock and roll, and this was abandoned by progressive rock. In 1970, then, the Christmas number one record was I Hear You Knocking by Dave Edmunds, a Welsh rock and roller. I will give you every year the Christmas number one. The record charts were avidly followed by millions of young people, and the Christmas number one was the holy grail of the popular music artist to get the number one at Christmas. This means a lot of people would buy it because it was a Christmas present, but it was the Christmas number one. Now, a series of things happened in 1970 which do not have a specific date, so I'm going to end the year with some information about non-specific dates. And in fact, every year I will end with undated events from the year, and then important publications which came out that year, three or four each year. But because books are part of history too, you know, it's not just laws. Yeah, books are very important parts of history. So, union membership, trade union membership, now accounts for nearly 50% of workers. And I've already mentioned that there were a very large number of strikes between 1968 and 1974. Many of them were small, local, unofficial, and successful. Although strikes are expensive for workers, they are far less risky for the individual in a situation where unemployment is very low and another job can easily be found if one is sacked. It's also been shown that when trade unions go on strike and win, people join the trade union. Nothing succeeds like success, you know. They think they're not there. And when they lose, people don't join. It's obvious, but it's really worth saying. In 1970, there were 7,499 people killed in road accidents. 7,500 people killed in road accidents. By 1980, this was less than 6,000. And in 2014, less than 2,000. This is a major change in the number of people killed on the road, despite the fact that, of course, in 2014, there are far more cars. Yeah. So, in fact, you're talking about a massive increase in road safety. The installing of front seat belts was compulsory in all new cars sold in the UK after 1972. So in 1972, it was obligatory to have a seatbelt in the car. It was not obligatory to fasten it until 1983. And in the 1970s, this was very controversial. People would argue about it and say, oh, seatbelts are a really good idea. No, seatbelts are a really bad idea. This was really a debate, yeah? I'm tempted. I don't like to conclude that it's because people were stupid, but, you know, And people say, yes, well, if you wear a seatbelt, you might have an accident to be trapped in the car and burnt. Which is true, but it's like 1 in 100 times, and the other 100 times you will have you save your life. You know, there you go. So massive decline in road accidents. Seatbelts, radar. All drivers hate radar, and it saves their lives. But there you go. That's my opinion. That's not really the 1970s. So finally, for 1970, a few important books from the 1970s. Have you heard of one of these?
Oh, yeah. Read them.
You've read the German Greens. Would you like to give a two sentence?
No, I don't.
Okay. So a very important feminist classic. A feminist classic. Yeah. So look at it. The Female Eunuch. So the idea is that present society has taken away the power and vitality of women. That's the female eunuch, that's the idea. So Germaine Greer, this was a bestseller. It was controversial, and probably if you read it today, you wouldn't agree with all of it. But, you know, that's not the... When you're trying to launch new ideas, you can't be too moderate about it. So quite an important book, The Female Eunuch. And like I say, a bestseller. This is the first edition. This is what it looked like. Yeah. And on the other side, you see Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. This was a Brazilian educationalist who wrote about new ways of teaching, new ways of involving oppressed groups and dominated groups in their education. So a very modern approach to education, which was very, very influential. I mean, among vaguely left-wing people, everybody read it in the middle of the 1970s, and that's my own copy, in fact. So this is also a sign of, you know, ideas going around the world, history of ideas. Germaine Greer is I think she's Australian, isn't she? So, you know, a lot of ideas going around the world. The Ecologist magazine was published for the first time in 1970, in July, in fact. Yeah, and so this is important because it was the first, and people said, a magazine about ecology, what's that? So it was a very, very new idea, and there was no political party, there was no Green Party, no Ecologist Party. This was the predecessor. And you can notice the titles that they have. Population Control for Britain. Yeah. So this is not generally what ecologist parties, mainstream ecology parties, push for today. Is there a peaceful atom? Yeah. So is nuclear power okay or not? I think they're going to say no. And look at the end. Yeah. Can we avoid a world famine? So it's quite catastrophist, really, isn't it? Yeah, a world famine, because today, you know, people are worried about famine, and people are worried about a lot of things, and quite often they're right. But a world famine, you know, we don't hear this kind. So certainly, when the ecologists began set up, then there were definitely a good number of let's say catastrophic ideas, and I will come back to that in the late. And gradually it shook itself out and came to be something which was militant, but more based on smaller changes. The atmosphere here was more we should all go and live on farms. You know, that was the sort of atmosphere which obviously is not practical for the number of people that you have here. Well, we just got to the end of 1 year, 1970. Isn't that good? We just got to the end of one year. I may have to go faster than this if we're going to get to the end. But I don't think so. I think at the beginning is longer. So that's all we have time for today. And I will see you next year for...